Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 130. Shrink Wrap Radio Live number 6 with guest Doug Davis, December 30, 2007. Hello there, everybody in Blog Talk Radio land. This is Dr. Dave, otherwise known as David Van Nuys, PhD. And I am here with my good friend, Jerry Trumbull, who's in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, Dave. How's it going out there?
It's going great here. And it'll be a little different for us doing this in the evening. We've been doing it in the morning. And I know that in the morning, I'm a morning guy. I'm very fresh in the morning. How about you? Are you a morning person?
Yes.
Or an evening person?
I usually get up and get going right away in the morning. I have to tell you, I was falling asleep about an hour ago, so hopefully I'll be able to wake up and have some stimulating conversation.
Yeah, well, I hope so. Now, in case anybody's listening to this for the first time, this is Shrink Wrap Radio. We have a regular Shrink Wrap Radio show that comes out about once a week. And that can be found on iTunes, and it can also be found at shrinkwrapradio.com, as well as psychologypodcast.com, and various other places on the web. I see that we have two people in the chat room right now, Honey Rococo, who was with us last week, an art student in Paris, and we also have guest 864. I'm not sure who guest 864 is. And if you want to identify yourself by name in the chat, guest 864, let us know if you're a regular listener to Shrink Wrap Radio or not. Be interested to know that. And we are expecting a drop-in guest this evening, Dr. Doug Davis, and I'm just waiting for him to call in. He is Professor Emeritus at Haverford College, and I think here he is. Let me just ring him in. Hey there, Doug. Are you on the line?
I seem to be. I hope I have the bandwidth to sustain the stream and so on. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you very well. I'd like to introduce you to my good friend, Jerry Trumbull.
Hello, Dr. Davis. Good to meet you.
Hi, Jerry. Glad to meet you.
You know, basically, we're up for just having a nice chat together. I've had you on the regular edition of Shrink Wrap Radio a couple of times, and those were much more scripted, where I had prepared a bunch of questions in advance. I assure you, I've prepared no questions in advance here.
So I get to both ask and answer the question.
Yeah, right? Yeah. But you're such a fascinating guy that
I can do the same. Yeah,
you're such a fascinating guy that I figured, okay, we don't need to have a bunch of questions or script. I was just in the process of introducing you to our audience. You are, I believe, Professor Emeritus at Haverford College of Psychology. That is, not Haverford College of Psychology, but Professor of Psychology, where you were chair for many years. And you've always had the most interesting career, having shuttled back and forth between the U.S. and Morocco, and having become fluent in Arabic, as well as being very much a high-tech guy. And that's one of the places where you and I have really been able to connect, is our interest in technology and the Internet. So let me stop talking and give you a chance to say something.
Yeah, you're right. My wife Susan, whom you also know, is a cultural anthropologist, and she introduced me to Morocco back in the 1970s, and I've been in and out of Morocco ever since. At Haverford, I was in a small psychology department, the person who did the psychodynamic psychology, the Freudian tradition, and I got very caught up in the Internet roughly about the time in the early 80s when I got my first microcomputer, an Apple II, and took it off to Morocco where we were studying adolescence. And I think what happened was I discovered that I was fascinated by a device that I could interact with in all the ways I could interact with on the computer. I could play games. I could read newspapers. I could store field notes and retrieve them later. And now, let's see, 25 years and roughly 20 personal computers later, I'm deeply enmeshed in cyberspace. And the parts of my life, the Freud part, the Morocco part, and the computer fascination, all seemed in the 90s roughly to fold together. I had a Fulbright in the mid-90s to study the social impact of the Internet in Morocco. And because I was already interested in the psychology of adolescence, I've been interested in how young people in Morocco and in the U.S. use personal computing and the net to sort of establish a personal space that they can share. We would now think in terms of MySpace. Before that, it was LiveJournal. And long before that, it was simply IRC chat and cutting and pasting information from one's own personal experience. And I guess I've become convinced over the years that the Internet is the new place where personality psychology, which is what my training is at Michigan, where we knew each other, the Internet is where personal psychology is coming to fruition. A former student of mine, I've had a lot of interesting student projects about various aspects of cyberspace, but one that really stands out was Nick Yee, who's now in California, just finished a PhD in communications at Stanford. And what Nick started to do when he was an undergrad at Haverford was to study EverQuest, which was one of the first very successful massively multiplayer role-playing games. And it became clear in the course of his study, which he has continued, and he probably now is the expert on the personal details of interactions with role-playing games and persistent worlds online, is all of a sudden you have a vehicle in which you can spin off avatars of yourself. You can be alternate people. You can be a barbarian warrior at one moment and an elf maiden at another, and you can try out styles of interacting that you couldn't easily pull off in real time, and you can escape the constraints of who you really are, as the New Yorker cartoon of some years ago says, with the two dogs looking at the computer on the Internet, no one knows you're a dog. You can be absolutely anybody you want to be. And
yeah,
Moroccan kids, just like American kids, love this. They love the idea that, you know, I can be a student at a Grande Ecole in France, and I can be hustling a beautiful girl from some other country. Now, the fact that I'm actually a 12-year-old kid in a rural Moroccan town in a cyber cafe, and the babe I'm hustling might actually be the young guy at the next computer, you know, I can sort of push into the background. So I've been a student of cyberspace and adolescence, and I guess convinced that that's where interesting personal psychology is happening now for a good many years.
Yeah, we have, by the way, we have Tom Barbalay, who is in our chat room, who was our guest 2 weeks ago, and he mentions that he's playing chess with his wife while listening. And when he was on, we were talking about artificial intelligence and artificial life, which is something that he's been involved with for a long time. And one of the things that we were talking about was he believes that the singularity has already happened. That is, that we've come to the place where a major shift has happened in terms of artificial intelligence, I guess, if you will. That's kind of a unique event in human history. And Jerry referred me to an article that I guess he found on your site about what's it called, Jerry? The Memorex?
Yeah, the Memex.
Yes,
the Memex.
I would appreciate if you could expand on that a little bit, Doug. I looked it up and I read it was kind of a early black box idea that all the information that a scholar or a researcher might want could be crammed into this box and be available at a moment's notice. And, of course, that's kind of what the Internet has turned into. Is that anywhere near correct?
Yeah, it was an immensely important moment for me. I don't remember exactly when, but some years ago. I mean, basically, my take on artificial intelligence, there's the kind that is purely a computer learning to be intelligent. You know, it passes the Turing test. You can't tell that it isn't an intelligent human being. And on that question, I'm sure we're headed in that direction, but I'm largely agnostic what it'll be like. I was influenced by Werner Vinge, who's a California computer scientist. He was a member of the computer science staff at UCSD, but I think he makes a living now with his science fiction novels. And although he talks about what hyperintelligence mediated by computers would be, when he gives lectures, he says, you know, to assume that a really alien intelligence that operates through a silicon-based software device will be intelligent in the way that we understand is like assuming that the goldfish in the bowl in our living room watches us go by and forms reasonable hypotheses about what it is we're up to. But on the question of whether there will be an intelligent computer network, I think it's perfectly clear that that happened because we take it for granted that we are intelligent, and millions of us now interact by means of the web and all of its various add-ons. Now, what the Memex idea was published in 1945 by Vannevar Bush, no relation, I think, to the ruling family in the U.S. Bush was Roosevelt's science czar during World War II, so he had some oversight on major projects like sonar and radar and the development of the atomic bomb. And he had been thinking throughout the war about the fact that scientific knowledge is increasing exponentially, and our ability to catalog and retrieve knowledge has barely improved, he says, since the 19th century. And we are in danger of losing our cultural heritage because we won't know how to make sense out of it. We won't know how to get at it. And he tries to imagine a device. He calls it a personal prosthesis to memory, and coins this term Memex. And he seems to imagine a kind of, refrigerator-sized or maybe PDP-11-sized device that you can drop pieces of paper into and they get electronically stored. You can store pictures. You can make wire recordings, and they can be retrieved. And he imagines that we will store all the information we might ever need to get back to, and we will develop very sophisticated cataloging tools that will allow us to get at the information efficiently. Now, in almost every respect, Vannevar Bush got it wrong about the technical details. He didn't imagine the kind of digital computers we now have. He didn't quite see what, although he imagines dry photography, quite what it would be. Certainly didn't imagine digital photography. But when he talks about what we'll do with our Memexes, like he has a wonderful digression on how you might get curious about the role of the English longbow in the Battle of Crecy. And when I read that, I, of course, immediately went out to Google and Googled Battle of Crecy and English longbow, and you find out that in the history of warfare, this was significant. And now that we take Google and Google Desktop, which respectively organize the billions of documents on the web in such a way that I can simply start typing in a term and it continues the term for me. It anticipates which public figure I'm looking for or what patent medicine. And it does the same thing for my own personal computer. And in my case, you know, I have notes that I made in Morocco in 1982 about conversations I had during long Ramadan nights. Google Desktop can immediately plunge me back into those moments of 25 years ago, and it can seamlessly integrate my own diary, which has been accumulating for all those years, with whatever is out there on the web. So I am effectively vastly more intelligent, at least in the sense of being able to retrieve information, but I think also in being able to arrange it and see what it's related to. And you know, for a 64-year-old man who occasionally has trouble remembering where he left his glasses, this is a wonderful gift. And it's a gift that is essentially available to everybody. And I got convinced in my last year of teaching, and I think it's one of the reasons I retired while I still had my wits about me and could travel back to Morocco and, you know, stay online, that we were about to see a real transformation in the way humans use their intelligence, the way they collaborate on projects, the way they spin off alternate versions of themselves, relying on the kind of information that only a few humans ever could simply retrieve from the wetware, you know, by simply querying memory. But it's relatively easy now to do online. So Memex became one of the terms that I used to organize my thinking about where the web is headed. And you may have found this, Jerry, I have three blogs that I'm currently more or less interested in, although not all of them get maintained regularly. One of them grows out of my years of teaching, and I call it class notes, and it's basically reflections on education in light of technology. One is, I call it my Al-Musharaka blog. Musharaka is an Arabic word that means collaboration, and it involves partly a project I worked on for the Mellon Foundation to help small colleges use technology in teaching. And the third I call my Memex, and some of the postings to my Memex are more or less literal pastings from my own diary, which I started keeping on an Apple II in 1982, and which I continue to maintain, with a lot of hyperlinks that illustrate to me and maybe to other people what it would be like to have a diary that not only reminds you that you had a conversation with so-and-so on such and such a day, but has a recording of the conversation. Or you listen to a news story and were reminded of an old Dylan song, and if you click here, you get to hear the Dylan song. So that it does what a diary does, but it does it in a multimedia way and potentially in a way that other people could share. Imagine a whole bunch of Memexes being launched by different people that are all connected with each other, I don't know, through RSS feeds or something. And we get to discover that, gee, there are other people who are interested in the Battle of Crecy or who are reading the same Pynchon novel and have the same curiosities about the anarchist movement and, you know, the mines of Colorado or whatever.
Let me cut in here for a moment just to let you know that I stupidly evidently failed to tell Blog Talk Radio that this was going to be an hour-long show. So it defaulted at 15 minutes, and the people who were in the chat room can no longer hear us. That's not going to be a huge problem because I'm going to later put this on the regular feed. I'm recording it separately from Blog Talk. So this will still be a podcast, but we're just not live anymore. However, there was a question from Honey Rococo in our chat room, who we know as Joni, who is a doctoral art student in Paris, an American in Paris, studying art history. And I wish she were going to hear this live, but I'm sure she'll hear it later. And she asked a question that really related to something you were talking about earlier, Doug. She says, okay, I do, you know, because you were saying, wow, what a great leap forward this is for humankind. And she says, okay, I do have a question for Dr. Davis. Why does he think it's the case that people in Second Life, rather than trying to experiment and change the world in utopian ways, instead simply reproduce the same sorry capitalist consumer world we've already got? I guess I'm thinking of something Jerry said had on his site, start your business in Second Life. Why are people so unimaginative, she asks. She says, I think we could do and be anything in cyberspace, but people are still working and getting plastic surgery for their avatars.
It's a good question, and I confess that although I've been interested in Second Life and I had a student who studied it a few years ago, I've never immersed myself in it, and most of what I've seen does suggest that you start out in a virtual shopping mall with a bunch of people with very improbable bodies saying to each other, so you from around here or what? And you can play bingo and you can, you know, there are political campaigns. I guess I assume that probably even now, if we knew where to look, we would find considerably stranger and more personal sub-venues in Second Life. Let me give you an example that comes from an earlier medium. And I think this was done within EverQuest, but it could have been done within any of several multiplayer games. The basic metaphor before Second Life and Dare.com, which are persistent worlds in which you can do whatever you want to, there was always a background of sort of Dungeons and Dragons or questing for some treasure or fighting with the other guys. But even there, a few years ago, there was a group in one of the MMORPGs, the massively multiplayer role-playing games, that basically got together on the game and found a private place where they wouldn't be bothered by people, you know, killing orcs and so on. And they would choreograph dance movements. They would then get together at a particular time and perform these things. And they would run, you know, 6, 8, 10, 12 minutes, and you'd see characters who looked like the bar scene in the first Star Wars movie.
Uh-huh.
All dancing in time to music and playing strange instruments and so on. Quite moving and quite strange. Uh-huh. And I remember showing it to a group of my students at Haverford. I taught a freshman writing class shortly before I retired, that I called my blog myself. And we treated blogs as literature that could be read, close read the way you read literature, and compared with existing diary literature, you know, Anne Frank and people in the Civil War and so on. And I thought it was fascinating that people would not only want to do something that's quite satisfying as a real-world medium, namely dancing, in a virtual setup where they were manipulating cartoon characters and going to all that work and then setting out for themselves strange, non-earthly, although admittedly sort of English-speaking bipeds, you know, Star Wars type characters to interact through. My fantasy when I spent a little time in Second Life and There.com was someday, maybe now that I'm retired, I'd like to set up a little space that's a little bit hard to find your way to. And you'd have to know something, maybe about Moroccan culture and Islam as a religion, maybe even Arabic as a language, maybe even get into some poetry.
This would be like going to see the guru, and you have to trek across a high mountain.
Exactly. And once you pass certain tests, you'd find yourself in a Moroccan interior, and here would be some representation of my Moroccan self. I go by the pseudonym Sidi Ram, S-I-D-I-R-O-M, and I don't think it's appropriate to make you sit and listen for the explanation why at this point. But all of a sudden, we would know by the fact that we were both in this space that we shared an interest in something.
Yeah.
And my current interest is Moroccan hip-hop. And we'd lapse into Moroccan Arabic, and we'd talk about Moroccan hip-hop, and there'd be a virtual jukebox. We could decide to listen to a cut together, and we could talk about it. Maybe we could, other people would be interested in performance. You want to do Balinese puppet theater, this would be a place to do it.
Well, in a way, that's the way the Internet as a whole is. I mean, Joni's criticism could have been leveled against the Internet. One could say, well, geez, you go on the World Wide Web and it's nothing but pornography and big companies with advertisements all over the place. And yes, that's true, but there are also these very specialized communities, such as you've described, you know, that are having very interesting conversations.
Yeah, and even in the world, you know, 10 years ago when we were the IRC chat was about as exotic as it got, you could quickly discover, and I was interested in this as somebody who was teaching about adolescence, you could be a troubled teenager somewhere out in some boondocks in the Midwest here, maybe, and you could be convinced that you were the only one having these spiritual doubts, or the only one who's worried about their sexuality, and you could suddenly discover that there seemed to be a lot of people. And
yeah.
You encountered people who you could talk to frankly, in a way you couldn't online. And the fact that you didn't know who these people were really is a minor difficulty, because I think we discover as teenagers we don't know who other people are.
Yeah, yeah. I want to get Jerry in here. Jerry?
Yeah, Jerry, yes. I'd love to hear from you, so let me shut up for a while and listen.
No, I've been following the conversation. I had an early experience. I also had an Apple II in 1980, I think it was, and fell into a chat room more or less by accident, and I was a lurker. I was just sitting there watching people chat, and all of a sudden somebody said to me, "What part of Denver are you from, Jerry?" And I was astounded, and I have to tell you, I was frightened to think that I could be identified as being from Denver from my, I thought it was anonymous, lurking position there. And I actually terminated the conversation. I didn't say anything. I was speechless. And translating now to, what, 20 years later on Second Life, I got into Second Life, and I thought, wow, this is fantastic, and tried to get Dr. Dave to set up a little shop in there and see if he could do some business. But it had a, I don't know, I, once again, I was sitting in a square watching people go by, noting their conversation, which the last time I checked, was still typing, although they said that they're going to have audio voice on soon. And a lady came up and sat down next to me, and I was going like, oh, maybe I'm just a shy person at heart. I don't know. But so I started talking to her, and at the time, I was interested in whether or not Second Life was starting up its own stock market. Now, that goes back to the earlier comment that why are we just translating our mundane life into this new world? Why aren't we doing all kinds of brand new things? I think there are brand new things going on, but they're mostly people talking to each other, discovering common areas of interest and so on. I don't know what these brand new things would be. People are still trying to make money. They're still trying to hit on women or men or whatever. And it's more or less like a translation of our everyday life onto cyberspace. What would the brand new things be?
Yeah, so in other words, humans are going to be humans doing their human thing no matter where they find themselves. And I guess that's been an enduring theme, really, of science fiction. Otherwise, the characters wouldn't be recognizable to us.
Well, I was sitting in the Second Life Square one time, and a giant came by that was so big that the foot that just like took up the whole square, and he just kept on walking. And I guess because people can write their own scripts and upload them, and I think that's actually the way the Second Life people make a lot of money, they can insert unknown things in there. One time I saw two creatures copulating in the square. I was surprised that, I mean, they were clearly copulating, but I was surprised that it was allowed to go on, but it wasn't even interesting. I mean, they were so weird. There was nothing fun about watching
them. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I want to step back to this article that you found on Doug's site about Vannevar Bush and, is it Licklider? You still with us, Doug?
Yeah, no, I'm still here.
Yeah, Licklider, where they make the point in that article where it's an article that looks back on their contributions and then kind of compares it to what we have today, which is Google. And I was very interested in the point that Google is essentially dumb. That is, there's no artificial intelligence that's been built into it. Rather, it works on a sort of brute force basis, following certain rules related to how many people have clicked on it and, you know, have linked to a site and so on. And to kind of make the point that it could be made much, much more powerful if they started imposing a certain amount of semantic and semantic intelligence, I guess. You want to comment on that, Doug?
Well, I think you're right, but let me quibble a little bit with how smart Google is. I mean, I don't believe that there's a being in there like the creatures of science fiction. But as you were speaking, Dave, I went to the Google window on my Firefox browser, and I entered Memex, M-E-M-E-X, and then spacebar, and then D2, which is my computer shorthand, you know, for Doug Davis.
Yeah.
First of all, it says, did you mean Memorex D2? And then the very first hit under that is D2 Memex. I promised to blog it, and what I have so far is the Memex website below, and it's my Memex blog. So had I eliminated the D2, I'm sure I would have wound up in a Wikipedia entry about Vannevar Bush in the article with probably a link to the full text from The Atlantic. By adding anything that linked it to me, I've got my own Memex. Now, presumably, if you two had Memexes, I could enter Memex Dr. Dave, and I'd suddenly be in David's. We would be almost a virtual community already. You know, I could drop a couple of RSS, markers in my blog, and all of a sudden, we'd be in some kind of dynamic relationship to each other. Now, for an egghead, for somebody who spent his whole life college teaching, that's already pretty exciting. If we ask what's exciting to the rest of the world, let me run a couple ideas by you. My student who studied Second Life 3 years ago, and I watched her wander around a bit, and nothing much seemed to be happening. And I said, well, do you know anybody? And she said, yeah, let me look at, you know, people I've become acquainted with. And she said, oh, yeah, I know this person. Let's find out where they are. And we found out where they were, and we flew there. Her character flew there, and it was a disco that was almost deserted. This was early in the afternoon, Eastern time. There was some fairly heavy dance music playing, and there was somebody up on a stage, and then in front of the stage, there was what looked like an animated tennis ball, you know, 5 feet in diameter with cartoon feet. Huh. And the tennis ball was dancing in time to the music. And Vicky said, I wonder how she or he is doing that. Sent a little message, and the other creature said, it's a script. Would you like it? I have it on my wrist. And then we accepted the script, and suddenly Vicky's character, which looks more humanoid female, is dancing to the beat. Well, so already we see how, if we were thinking capitalistically, we could open a tango studio, right?
Right.
Tango together. And but certainly we could do other kinds of dances. You witnessed, I assume, a banal copulation between two characters. Imagine something that was more like a Vulcan mind meld, and then the two characters morph together, and they acquire each other's characteristics, and suddenly they can interact in new ways. And imagine that the individuals interacting are not, you know, naive teenagers trying to imagine romance, but people who've had considerable experience. I don't see any reason why, in principle, it couldn't become a lot more subtle. Up till now, what's amazing about people's investment in virtual worlds, whether it's EverQuest or World of Warcraft or Second Life, is that people will spend 20, 30, 40, 50 hours a week essentially manipulating cartoon characters, where all they get back is a two-dimensional view of other cartoon characters and some text chat. But let's imagine that we're just a few years down the road, and everybody's wearing a wetsuit that provides tactile sensation to the body and body feedback, and you're running scripts that allow you to experience something much more like, you know, sort of full-body tactile feelings. You've got audio. You still have the abilities to teleport and do other things. I have a feeling people are going to think of more interesting things to do with those media.
Right. And I think
so you from around here or what, right?
Yeah, I think that will be the singularity.
Well, but yeah, there was a white guy with dreadlocks back in the 90s named Jason Lanier. I haven't heard about him recently, and I haven't Googled him, but he's got a startup company going, and it didn't go anywhere because for a lot of money, you got something pretty clunky. But the idea was you had tactile feedback, and you could sort of feel where you were. He described the medium that he was creating as teledildonics, and I think he intended it to be suggestive in the way it was. And he suggested that people would, in the future, be having, he called them, reality conversations. And I remember an interview with him where the interviewer says, sounds kind of like acid, man. And he says, please don't use that word. He said, you know, the last thing you want is for people to think that they can map this onto some, you know, drug problem of the past. It's going to be something much more different. And I think if you're a teenager and you don't have the, you know, quite yet have the courage to go to the real dance on Friday and you're sitting home with Second Life, that's one thing. Imagine that you're, I don't know, immersed in Borges or something. You know, you've got a stranger view of how the world works. And here's a tool where you could write scripts that would bend physical reality and allow you to have skills you don't have. We're at least one step toward the moment in the first Matrix movie where Neo says to Trinity, can you fly an X-55 helicopter? And she says, not yet. And then there's a moment of thoughtfulness on her face, remember, and suddenly she's an experienced pilot.
No, I didn't remember that.
I think that's going to be very seductive.
Yeah.
And I guess the question is, will people who have those physical capabilities, will they find time to do the other things I think are interesting about our species, you know, like ask philosophical questions and wonder about God and try to improve their chess openings and so on?
Well, that's a good question, because it's one that I used to put to my students was, you know, what if they're able to develop this sort of technology to the place where you can enter into an artificial reality that feels totally real and basically have all of your wishes granted. Wouldn't that become totally addictive? And would you want to just stay there, or would you have some reason not to stay there? And that was always good for some discussion.
Yeah, I mean, Freud, as you know, my sheikh, asked himself that question, and he thought if you didn't have, if you could easily not have to look for a real object of your affections, civilization would collapse. I'm reading him in a slightly extreme way here. But, you know, it's the fact that we have to work to make real-world connections that keeps civilization going. And I think he probably would have seen this as a fairly scary venture in our fairly scary moment in our technological advancement, that suddenly, you know, as in Second Life, everybody's beautiful, everybody has amazing superpowers and so on, and you don't have to work hard to get anything. And then I think we're probably in the Dylan moment where he says, you know, this is what salvation must be like after a while.
Right. Very boring.
Yeah.
Well, Doug, you would have appreciated a conversation as a Freud scholar that I was having with another friend yesterday, where I recently changed the logo for Shrink Wrap Radio, which, as you know, was kind of an Andy Warhol treatment of a picture of Freud. And because when I went to have T-shirts made, I found that the T-shirt company was not willing to use an image of an actual person for fear of some suit. And in fact, I realized that I had been in jeopardy for some time. And so, you know, I've now got a different logo that doesn't use Freud. But as I was chatting with my friend yesterday, I was observing that there is no other image. There's no other person, I think, that you could use that would universally suggest psychology to people other than Freud. He is, and he wasn't even a psychologist per se, but he is probably the most famous visual figure in psychology all of these years later. Kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think you're quite right. I think, you know, if you majored in psych, then Skinner or Watson or somebody might work for you, but for the world in general, it's Freud. And I think Freud, I had another brilliant Haverford student a few years ago, Mike Oswalt, who also studied, he compared three different genres of computer-mediated game, you know, a shooter game and a strategy game and a role-playing game. The role-playing game is EverQuest. But he wrote an introduction that really should have been published in its own right. He took Freud's 1930 idea in Civilization as Discontents of Sublimation, where you learn to substitute culturally valued ways of satisfying your impulses, albeit maybe not completely, for the primitive ways that would have been destructive. And he rethought it in light of where computer technology was rapidly headed. And I think that's work that really needs to be done. I think somebody really does need to sit down and do as wild and ambitious a read on the totality of human culture as Freud attempted between the two world wars, in light of where we are now. There's good science fiction, the cyberpunk writers, you know, it's they who in the 1980s start using terms like cyberspace and matrix and so on, and imagining virtual worlds that are fully immersive and so on. But in terms of systematic psychological thinking, I don't think there's much. My favorite book is still one that came out in the mid-90s, I think 95, by Shelley Turkle at MIT called... Sherry Turkle's book was called Life on the Screen, and has some wonderful notions at that relatively early period in the web about how people were going to use this technology. One of her MIT students says, you know, Sherry, for me, reality is just another window. And you imagine somebody at a very high-powered computer system where they've maybe got a chess game going, they've got a virtual character they're playing, they're chatting in some very complicated way, but there is one window on the screen that is what's going on outside, or, you know, traffic. It's like a friend who works at Microsoft and keeps a window open where you can see the traffic patterns in Seattle, so you can decide when to dash from your desk and leap in your car and, you know, try to catch that little pocket to get yourself home. And I think it's very hard for traditionally trained social scientists to imagine what it's going to be like to grow up with those possibilities, where anything that can be represented as a video that's happening is knowable in real time. So when I was driving down to the cities the other day from our lake here in Minnesota, I could actually look where there were traffic events in the Minneapolis-St. Paul system, and I could see the mounted camera's image of how the cars were moving. And in principle, I could be doing that for any place in the world. Any real event I could be monitoring. At the same time that I can have utterly fanciful worlds in which human beings don't look human anymore and look like characters from Star Wars, or they've transgendered themselves, or they've done other things that are really hard to imagine. And all of that with the benefits of Google and Google Desktop, which makes me seem immensely smart because I'm only a couple clicks away from knowing what the Battle of Crecy was and how the English longbow actually worked.
Hmm. You know, I don't use Google Desktop, and it sounds like it's very important in your universe. Sell me on it.
Well, I've been keeping a diary since we went up to Harvard on this postdoc that took us to Morocco. And the result is that if I want to know how I reacted to D.M. Thomas's The White Hotel in the summer of 1982 from a village in Morocco while the Israelis were in Lebanon and, you know, and so on, all I have to do is go to Google Desktop and say, White Hotel. And there I am. And I can half remember a conversation I had with a Moroccan friend about how hypocritical some of the supposedly pious Muslims around the Gulf were, and enter hypocrisy and maybe Ramadan, because that's when the conversation occurred. And suddenly I'm on a street late at night talking to my friend about what the prophet had to say about hypocrisy.
You mean this is because now, you have a diary on your desktop?
That's right.
A link and to a diary.
The diary has been essentially the major work of the last half of my life. It's,
wow.
I don't know how many pages it would work out to be because I don't print it. Because
yeah.
If I printed it and tapped on the underlined words, nothing would happen. But on the screen, I'm connected to all the other features of my life. And I think
you've hyperlinked it all.
To each other in the 60s, I was reading The Interpretation of Dreams, although I didn't have the terminology then, as an example of what a magical place the world would be if you understood how to make sense out of your dreams, where all the themes of your current life are thrown together in a cobbled together little animated story that, as you start to think about it, tumbles you back into the significant earlier moments of your life. And that tumbling back into your earlier life is, at least for this psychologist, greatly facilitated by Google Desktop.
Interesting.
And the fact, Doug, that you have kept this diary over the years. To me, that's the unusual fact. I use Google Desktop, and it brings me up what I've written on various blogs and so on and so forth. But I haven't been keeping a diary like you have, so I've kind of lost all that.
Yes, and I'm very aware that a year before I started keeping the diary, I'm in a very different relationship to my life. And, of course, there are periods when I don't happen to be around a computer. The other thing I should probably say in passing that for me has turned out to be significantly related. I was in junior high school when Sputnik went up in 1957, and there was no way I was going to, as a serious student of science, I was going to waste time learning how to type. So after all these years at a keyboard, I probably produce about 12, 14 words a minute. But I run Dragon Naturally Speaking, version 9, and I'm going to do a little demo for a retirement community near Haverford, and I was imagining that I was introducing my talk and why I think this software is cool live on the screen, and I can produce 130 words a minute.
Wow.
And the result is that after a good strong cup of coffee, I can settle back in my chair and actually close my eyes and think, what do I feel now about Freud's idea of sublimation? Well, first I think such and such, and second I think such and such. And, you know, 8-10 minutes later, open my eyes and lo and behold, there's text.
Amazing.
Now, imagine, for example, if we were interacting in a virtual world and we were talking to each other, but we knew that there would be a full transcript, which means it's searchable, it's Googleable.
Mm-hmm. Now, that idea I like a lot. And the tests that I've done with programs like Naturally Speaking were a few years ago, and I found it to be cumbersome because it tried its best, but it was often wrong, and editing it was a bigger pain than just trying to write it in the first place. So it must have improved quite a bit since then. Is that true?
Well, no, you're quite right, Jerry. And in fact, what I've had to do to really benefit from this program is not watch the words appear. The speech recognition software can't misspell, which means spell checkers are no help to you at all, but it can produce bizarrely meaningless entire phrases and sentences. If you think of the crazy secretary in Being John Malkovich,
right,
has a
right.
comprehension disorder, and she's got her boss convinced that he has a speech disorder. So I'm talking along, and maybe I mentioned my Moroccan friend, and I open my eyes, and here's a phrase: "Ham needs an ashtray." that's what Hamid al-Asri would sound like, right? If you'd never heard Arabic. But the nice thing is, you can then click on that, and you can say, "Play that back," and there will be the words. Now, if David Pogue, who does technology for the New York Times, has a Thursday column, and he's written several times about using Naturally Speaking, he claims he produces 125 words a minute for his column almost without error. And I think it's true because he's using a well-delimited vocabulary. If I'm trying to speculate about a book I'm reading, there are enough novel words to get in the way. But the difference between being able to get raw prose out at over 100 words a minute and 15 is so profound. It's much easier for me to edit a draft than it is for me to be patient with the painful rate at which my thoughts actually appear. And of course, the other thing I've started to do, I'm carrying a little, it's a SanDisk's competitor to the iPod, the Sensa. And, you know, it allows me to download podcasts and listen to music and FM and so on, but it's got a nice little MP3 recorder. And I make notes to myself. And with a podcast medium, you can easily make your local recordings available to other people in as much as you want to. And I think, and it's going to take a while because the educational system isn't very happy with all of these technologies, but if you imagine that we could set the cultural clock back a couple thousand years and behave like Romans, as I understand the Romans, it wasn't about writing. It was about speaking. It was about being able to produce fairly long, well-structured arguments verbally that scanned well, or would have scanned well if they were written down. We have an educational system in which we require students to write ever more phony papers. So they finally write these bizarre passive voice, it was expected that the experimental group would show such and such a characteristic. And then when they leave the classroom, they leave all their intelligence and articulateness behind, and you have this, so then I'm saying to her, but I'm dull, like, well, and so on. If we got in the habit of making sense verbally, and we had a tool that we knew could record our raw speech, could turn our slightly less than raw speech into reasonable prose, and could make that prose available to us for the rest of our lives via Google Desktop, and selectively to everybody else via blogs and so on, I think, again, the world would get rapidly more interesting.
I'll sign up for that.
Okay, well, maybe when I set up business on Second Life,
right.
On one side of the street, right, turning people's neurotic misery into common unhappiness, right, and I could be on the other side with my little CD-ROM show, and we'll see where people get to.
Are you reading any science fiction these days?
You know, it's a little harder for me to say where science fiction stops and the other stuff I like. I mean, I'm a big fan, I may have mentioned this to you, David, before, of Richard Powers. And some of Powers' stuff touches science fiction. I just read The Echo Maker this summer, which I really loved. Dan Simmons. I was actually just telling a friend earlier today, who wrote the Hyperion books back in the 80s, has a two-part, and I think there's going to be a third novel. It's a futuristic remake of the Iliad and the Odyssey, with post-humans have terraformed Mars and reincarnated Trojan and Greek warriors and scholars who are observing the battle. We don't know why yet, and it has turned, the first volume is called Ilium and the second one Olympus. It's turned into what I felt after I read the Iliad, which is the Greeks needed to agree that their earthly problems were trivial compared to these schmucky gods that were manipulating them all the time and they decided to rebel, and that's what's going on in the novels. I would recommend both of those.
Wow. Well, you know what? I think we're coming to the place maybe where we should begin to draw to a close. And one of the things that I wanted to do was to make sure that we get some email addresses out for people who might want to correspond with us. So, of course, I can be reached at shrink@shrinkwrapradio. Jerry?
I'm at Trumbull, Trumbulle, at msn.com.
And Doug, I don't know if you want to put yourself out there or not.
Oh, I don't mind at all. My email address that will keep working for years, I assume, is ddavis@haverford.edu. Haverford is Haverford. But as I like to tell people, if you simply Google Doug Davis or D2 and Nemex or Mushaka or Haverford or Freud or Morocco, you'll drop into one of my blog entries and they all have ways to get back to me or to comment.
Be careful, though. You might fall down a wormhole and find yourself in some very curious corner of the universe.
That's always possible. That's right. Yeah.
Hey, Doug, thanks so much for being willing to drop in
with
David,
us. David, it's a pleasure. I guess let's do another one where Doug gets to be a lurker and I get to hear you and Jerry talk. I did listen to one of the earlier broadcasts, yeah. And I will go back now and catch up.
Oh, great. Great. Thank you. Well, thanks a lot.
Okay.
And
it was a pleasure.
Great. And Jerry, thank you for being on hand, Jerry.
No problem, Dave.
And shall we have a chorus of all three saying it's all in your mind?
We could try.
Okay, one, two, three. It's all in your mind.